Okay. Only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first... There. The last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Chosen by Red Bull when he was just 15. Launched into his Grand Prix debut as the youngest ever driver. Jaime Alguersuari had never even driven an F1 car before, but he had to take his chance.
I think you never say no to Formula One. This world is like the stock market. It's unpredictable. Like, you never know what's going to happen. So as soon as you have an opportunity, you take it. Especially if you're a Red Bull driver and you're giving a Red Bull opportunity, you don't say no.
Jaime was told he needed to win. He was dropped when he didn't. His F1 story ended just as quickly as it started.
Whoever is against whoever, you are always going to be judged by Helmut Marko. Even if you win races, even if you are world champion, Helmut will just give you the hand and tell you that he's happy, but you have to keep on winning. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what they expect you to do.
I'm Tom Clarkson, and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid. The drivers who made their F1 debuts in 2025 had all driven in practice sessions or private tests prior to the season opener in Melbourne. They'd had time to prepare. Jaime Alguersuari had none of that when, in 2009, he was thrust into a race seat with Toro Rosso, the team we now call Racing Bulls. He got up to speed quickly and scored points in his 2.5 seasons at the top echelon. But just as suddenly as he'd been promoted, he found himself out of the sport with no route back. We recorded this conversation in February, long before Red Bull swapped Liam Lawson and Yuki Tsunoda. But Jaime's experience of racing in the Red Bull family and the high expectations placed on the drivers by motorsport advisor Helmut Marko is fascinating and poignant. Jaime is now concentrating on tracks of a different kind, as a DJ and music producer. He says music saved his life after he left F1, and we'll hear one of the songs at the end of the episode. But before that, I think you'll enjoy hearing his story of a rapid rise, 2.5 tough seasons in Formula One, and how he turned down a race-winning car just days before being dropped. Jaime, it is lovely to see you. Long time no speak. Must be, I think, 13 years.
Wow. Really?
Time flies.
13 years.
You don't look a bit different.
I do. We all do. I mean, aging is happening for everyone.
Look, you're looking very fit and well.
Thank you.
Are you Formula One fit still?
I don't think I'm Formula One fit still. I mean, if I would really push myself into losing some kilos and going back there, physically, there might be a chance, of course, to get in the car, first of all, and then to manage pushing every single lap for 70 laps or for 2 hours race long. Maybe there would be a chance, but of course, it's now none of my business. But thank you so much.
I mean, your business is very different now. We're sat in your studio in Barcelona. Do you think of yourself as a music producer now, or once a racing driver, always a racing driver?
Well, you made me think about this one. But yeah, I think I'm still a racing driver, mentally, not technically. I mean, of course, I would be quite quick, I would say, if I would drive a car, not like a normal human being, of course, because I had this skill from back in the day. But now I don't do this anymore. You know, I'm I'm a music producer and a DJ, and this is what I'm focusing my life since I'm retired. So, yeah.
When did music become part of your life? Were you making music when you were racing in Formula One?
Music is part of our lives all the time. Music is present everywhere. I don't know any soul in this world that doesn't like music. Everybody in this world loves music and is influenced by music. So for me, I was very young, like even when I was 6, 7, that I was already feeling influenced by films and music. But obviously people see a character, just a racing driver growing up as a racing driver. But also a racing driver has feelings and emotions, you know. So for me, it was very clear that the day I ended my career, I wanted to do something I loved, which was my hobby, which was making music with my computer. And then that went into making electronic music with soul, of course.
Did music help your performance in Formula One? I mean, I'm thinking of Daniel Ricciardo, always used to be almost dancing on the grid before getting in the car, whereas others like Oscar Piastri now don't listen to music. Did music help you get in the right frame of mind?
Absolutely. Like 1,000,000%. Music saved my life, especially because you listen to music all the time when it's a good time to celebrate, when it's time to concentrate, when it's a sad time. It's for every human being, not just Formula One drivers. So especially the way I went off Formula One, music saved my life. Because without music, really, honestly, Tom, I have no idea what I would have done with my life, because I would have not known what to do. So there was a purpose for me. I mean, there was a goal in my head to say, okay, I'm heading to my studio straight away because I really, really want to do this big time.
Look, we'll come back to music. Let's talk about that Formula One career that we've alluded to so far. How do you reflect on those 2.5 years with Toro Rosso in Formula One, the 46 races? I think there were 31 points in total.
Well, it was a great adventure. I've been always fighting since I was a kid. I wouldn't say the goal was to make it to Formula One, because in my family, we never talked about you have to be there, you know, you have to be one of the top 20 drivers in the world. We just went step by step, and the things that step by step in my life went very fast. I managed to get in the junior team of Red Bull when I was 15, and then they pushed me into Formula One. And then all of a sudden, I found myself after half a year, well, scoring points and I would say doing a good job with my teammate with that car. So all in all, looking back, I have a great feeling of that adventure. It didn't end up the way I expected to end, or it didn't end up the way I wanted to end, because I didn't want to end that experience. Obviously, I was there in order to do something else. I was there and I was feeling I had non-finished business with Formula One. But overall, I have great memories. I met amazing people. I had so much fun with other drivers in racing against them. And all in all, wow, super experience.
I mean, let's go through that in chronological order. You talk about getting on the Red Bull program age 15. That was at a time when Red Bull had a search for... They wanted an American Formula One driver, didn't they? And Danny Sullivan, former F1 driver, former Indy 500 winner, he was given the job of finding the next American F1 driver. So how surprising was it for you that they chose a Spaniard?
Well, indeed, I'm actually very surprised you knew about this, because not a lot of people know about this story. I wasn't expected to be in Estoril 2005 for the driver selection. I just received a phone call from my family telling me to go to Estoril to do this casting, you know, that lasted for 5 laps. And I thought it was a joke, because I'm like, how can they judge a driver only on 5 laps, based on 5 laps? Well, I think Helmut Marko knew enough what he was doing back then, because he had like around 60 to 70 drivers to judge, or at least to see if they were valuable to give them a contract. They were only selecting 4 or 5 out of 70 drivers. And I was one of them. I don't remember the rest, but one of them was Brendan Hartley. So he was selected on the same driver selection that year.
So you're at Estoril. You get those five laps, age 15. Do you think it was chosen purely on pace, or were they looking at other things as well?
They were looking at spontaneity. And I think that's the most important thing about a racing driver. Doing something unnatural with a very unnatural age. By this I mean I was only 15. I was the youngest ever, coming in the last minute and all of a sudden being the fastest in three laps, or doing the fastest lap time of them all in three laps. So for Helmut back in the day, it was enough to understand that this guy should have a contract. But if you look later on, and if you look at great drivers, and I just don't put myself in there, you can put many, many examples. You have to judge drivers in junior categories by doing great things with very, very young age. They don't need much experience. They just go there, and on the first year of Formula 2 or Formula 3 championship, they already win the championship. And this happens. Nico Hülkenberg did it. Max did it.
Lewis Hamilton did it.
Many other drivers did it. And you know it's a great racing driver, and it's going to be a fantastic racing driver forever, because you know he's doing something unnatural that other drivers can't, and they need 2 or 3 years in order to win championships. So that spontaneity I'm talking about is where you recognize great racing drivers doing such an amazing things.
What do they say? You can make a fast driver consistent, but you can't make a slow driver fast.
Exactly.
So they're looking for speed.
Yeah.
And of course, you go on to win the British Formula 3 Championship 3 years later, 2008, beating four other potential or future Formula 1 drivers, including Checo Perez, actually. You beat him that year, didn't you? And then, look, the F1 call, right? Midway through 2009, you suddenly appear in Hungary. Now, I was very aware of what you'd achieved the previous year in British Formula 3, but I, for one, wasn't expecting to see you at that race. Tell us about the build-up to it.
There was no build-up, actually. I mean, it was very tough days because I couldn't test the car. I barely knew the racetracks, only the ones in Europe, a little bit. And Formula 1, back in the day, is so different, was so different to other racing series, especially Formula 3, because first of all, you have different compounds, you have much more people involved, there's so much data around. It's not about just putting your helmet on and, you know, putting the throttle down. It's about understanding the dynamics of the team and how the data works, how the downforce and the aerodynamics works, how the session, FP1, FP2 qualifyings work, the whole weekend. And analyzing all this information at home and becoming successful, it requires experience. It's not that easy to jump in with no experience, no mileage, no testing, no understanding of the tires, of the racetracks, and then you're going to be fast, because it's not going to happen.
So just to be clear, you had never driven a Formula One car before FP1 in Hungary?
Never. My first experience with a Formula One car was in FP1 in Hungary. So I remember Giorgio Ascanelli saying, "Hey kid, come on. At the end of the day, this is a car with a steering wheel and two pedals." So he was trying to put some pressure out, because everyone, you know, normally FP1, especially the first 10, 15 minutes, nobody wants to go because the track is dirty and they wait for track evolution whatsoever. And I really wanted to go straight away, because obviously my intention is to do as many laps as possible. And the aim for the weekend was to finish the Grand Prix. I was not caring about lap times, performance. I think I finished P14, which wasn't that bad. Of course, some people retired. But at least it was my first time that I did a two-hour race, because Formula 3, you do half an hour races. So physically it was very tough, and also mentally.
I find it crazy that they put you in that position. You were, at the time, the youngest driver ever to race in Formula 1. What was it? 19 years, 4 months.
Yeah.
Why did they put you in that position? I mean, even look at today's, but the simulators were nothing like they are today. Even the rookies of today get FP1 sessions to get used to the app, you know, the environment, working with great engineers like Giorgio Ascanelli. Yet you were just thrown in. Why did Red Bull do that?
For one reason, and it was very simple. back then in the junior team, I was, let's say, the leader. I won that championship that put me in a position where I should be the next one to go. There was nobody else. And the second thing, of course, you know, you have to have several things going on your way. You just don't have to be good and talented and winning championships. And the second thing was that Sebastian Burde, back in the day, he was the official driver at Toro Rosso. He was being beaten by my ex-teammate, who is Sebastian Buemi, who also, Burde, got beaten by Sebastian Vettel. So he got beaten twice. And there is a rule in Formula One, or there should be a rule, that if you're being beaten consistently by your teammate, you're in trouble. Especially if you're in Red Bull and you're working with Helmut Marko. So I think that was the first time, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, that there was a driver, by the lack of his performance, that he was thrown away in the middle of the season. Because I don't remember any case that drivers were being just dropped in the middle of the season just because of their performance. So that's the reason, actually.
I mean, we've seen the snakes and ladders between Toro Rosso and Red Bull Racing, drivers being promoted and demoted. But yes, for one to be just discarded
in the middle of the season,
of the season was very unusual.
Unusual.
I remember Felipe Massa that weekend. He was racing for Ferrari. He'd run Lewis Hamilton very close the year before. He was, you know, part of the establishment at the time. I remember him saying, you can burn yourself very quickly in Formula One when asked about you making your debut. Were you concerned about that?
I remember Mark Webber more than Felipe. And I really remember his quotes. And I had a great relation with Mark after that, of course. But I remember he was saying, Formula One is not a school. You should have done your homework before coming into here. Honestly, that hurt. Because I didn't feel welcomed by the other drivers when I reached Formula One. I didn't feel super respected. The guy who actually helped me a lot was Marc Genet. He let me use his TechnoGym machine for the neck and let me train at home for the neck before the Grand Prix, of course. And of course, all the Red Bull family, Mr. Mateschitz, Franz Tost, all the guys who were working back then, they were helping me to start. But in general, the drivers didn't give me a warm welcome when I made my debut. No.
It's a tough environment. And I think Mark Webber, remember, 2 years previous to that, had been taken out behind the safety car at Fuji by Sebastian Vettel. And he'd come up with that quote, walking back to the garage, kids.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was a swear word then,
yeah,
kids.
Yeah, I remember it. Yeah.
And so he'd sort of... Yeah. He'd been on the receiving end of the kids. So I think he was, as you say, very outspoken about that. And also, let's not forget that Felipe Massa was managed by Nicholas Todd, as was Sebastian Bourdais. So, you know, maybe Massa was just giving a little bit of support to his fellow stable. But in terms of pace, I know you say you weren't looking at lap times. You were 0.8, I think, slower than your teammate in your first qualifying session, having only done a handful of laps. I remember thinking you'd acquitted yourself very, very well.
Thank you. Well, for me, the most important thing of the weekend was not really the lap time itself, was just to understand the dynamics of the team, the debriefs, the briefings, so many engineers going around, and understand what to say, how to say it, and to get the right feedback, the right emotions as well. And to get it all under control, or as much as under control as I can, in order to deliver for the next race. Because I knew at some point I was going to be judged, and lap performance is going to matter. So we need to see this Jaime Alguersuari just increasing his performance and doing better. And I knew for me to start is going step by step and understanding every single bit of the car.
This may come across as a mad question, but did you at any point leading up to Hungary say to Helmut, I don't think this is the right thing for me. I think I should wait.
No, you never.
You never say no to Helmut.
No. No, you can. You actually have to say no to Helmut. But I think you never say no to Formula One, because you never know. This world changes so much. It's so difficult to predict. It's like the stock market. It's so difficult. It's unpredictable. Like, you never know what's going to happen. So as soon as you have an opportunity, you take it. especially if you're in, if you're a Red Bull driver and you're giving a Red Bull opportunity, you don't say no. I mean, you're not in any position to say no.
But how different might it have been for you had you had a full winter of testing leading up to your first race instead of zero mileage?
Well, it would have made a big difference because I was going to war without weapons. I couldn't defend myself. But my mileage was, or my testing was, the races. That's the only thing I could say. And I had Mr. Matysits on my phone telling me to take it easy. To be honest, in some sort of way, I just didn't want to crash the car. Because every time I had a crash, it's not just that I was costing money to the team, but also I was not doing the mileage. And for me, Formula One is not just only speed, but there is a lot about thinking precisely. You know, it's, you see Carlos Sainz winning last year in Singapore and how he won it. He didn't win by speed. He won because he was more intelligent from the rest. So Formula One is a tactic game sometimes. And you have to understand there's a lot of work that it's being done when you take your helmet out, when you're in the factory, when you work with your engineers, when you spend time with your data, with the data, with understanding how every single compound works, the tires. There's so many factors that make performance difference. And that's why for me was very, very important. Don't crash the car, do the mileage, try to be as consistent as possible. And then let's see how far off we are. But let's not focus now about the speed.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
We've all been stuck in a dinner routine rut, bored with the same takeout options, or eaten a bowl of cereal for dinner. But picking tonight's meal doesn't have to be stressful. Here's an idea. Let Cook Unity handle dinner tonight with premium meals delivered right to your door. New menu drops, weekly recommendations, and a growing community of award-winning chefs. Your meal options are endlessly delicious with a team of over 160 innovative chefs curating an ever-expanding menu of small batch meals. Cook Unity offers a variety of over 400 meals for every palate. Cook Unity has flexible programs that you can pause, skip, or cancel at any time. Find the perfect plan for your dietary needs and lifestyle. Shake up your meal routine. Go to cookunity.com/rut or enter code RUT before checkout for free premium meals for life. That's free premium meals for life at cookunity.com/rut.
Still to come in this episode, Jaime talks about racing Michael Schumacher and how he turned down the chance to drive a race-winning car. And on F1's other official podcasts at the moment, you can hear F1 Nation's preview of the Japanese Grand Prix with me, Sky Sports presenter Natalie Pinkham, and F1 correspondent Lawrence Barreto. And this week's F1 Explains is all about the skills F1 drivers need to race a car on the limit. Why not check out F1 Nation and F1 Explains after this episode of F1 Beyond the Grid? You were the youngest there had ever been at that point. Then fast forward to 2015, Max Verstappen comes in age 17. Just as an aside, what did you make of the way Max dealt with things age 17?
Unique. You can resume it in one word. I think it's unique. And the reason why it's unique is because I think Max had a very different education than anybody else. In karting, the way he trained, the way he competed in everything, shifter karts, normal karts. He was competitive on every single environment, on every single circumstance he was giving. He had pure speed. And it's not just a gift from God. It's also, it's like those gifts that Tiger Woods have and all the greatest sportsmen in the world. This is hard work. It's not just a gift from the sky, you know, it's hard like a lot of work, like really, really a lot of work. And this is why Max was so successful from the very, very start. And I think that's why he was unique. Even though I think Formula One also during the years, especially when I left, changed massively. It was the tires, the fuel, everything was, the engines, everything changed so much and made, I don't think cars slower, but cars to drive very differently than back in the day. Or it required different abilities. However, what Max did, it was unique.
Did you understand that you needed to work at your talent in the way that Max did?
Well, I think Max is unique, because especially the way they created him, the way that Josh, his dad, created him. It doesn't happen, because 99% of the times you create someone like that, you fail. There's nobody that can cope with that amount of pressure and dealing with that amount of responsibility. And we know that this is, you know, like super, it's a famous story, like what, how Max delivered, how Max performed on every single category is out of understanding on not just in Formula One, especially in other racing series. So you could clearly see that was, that's what I was talking about before, about spontaneity. You can tell from lap one that this is something else. And probably he has some weaknesses that we have never seen yet, probably.
When you see him drive now, what stands out? Why do you think Checo Perez struggled so much against him? Checo Perez being someone you beat in Formula 3.
Firstly, because I think is the for the first time ever in his career, Checo finds himself with the hardest man to beat, with the hardest teammate to beat ever. Secondly, because there's the environment in Red Bull is what it is. You know, to be in Red Bull against Max, whoever is against Max or whoever is against whoever, you are always going to be judged by Helmut Marko. Even if you win races, even if you are world champion, Helmut will just give you the hand and tell you that he's happy, but you have to keep on winning. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what they expect you to do. So we were not celebrating Christmas and birthdays in Red Bull, you know what I mean? So I think Checo wasn't really expecting that environment. And secondly, because there was so much pressure from everyone, from the press, everyone talks about it. And he knew he couldn't deliver as Max. So he was getting in the car. That's the worst thing that can happen to a racing driver. Putting in his helmet on, knowing that there's no chance he's gonna reply to his lap times.
What? Because you then start overdriving.
Of course.
And
overthinking, overdriving.
Yeah. One thing leads to another.
Doing and carrying stupid mistakes instead of thinking, okay, let's focus on myself and let's forget for a second about my teammate and forget about my teammate, about Max, and let's focus on what I'm able to do and how to bring my 120%, and then we'll see where we are. So obviously, it was very tough for him to get himself into balance, you know.
Back to you now, and let's talk about pressure. Giorgio Ascanelli was trying to help dissipate that by saying it's, you know, it's like any other car.
Yeah.
How much pressure was there on you from someone like Helmut Marko? What did he expect from you in that first half season?
Helmut always expects to do something that is out of reach. In 2010, there was a system that for many newcomers, maybe they don't know, it's called the F-duct. That was something that McLaren bring to test in Barcelona. And from then, every team copied it, except a couple of teams like us. We couldn't do it because we weren't good enough to do that system. And that derived into the DRS. So in 2010, we were the only team that scored points without DRS, let's say, officially. But it doesn't matter for Helmut. It didn't matter for Franz Tost I guess it did, but on our face, we were just not good enough. They were expecting that we did miracles. And I remember I had a meeting with Helmut in Japan, in Suzuka. He made me sign this contract. It was like extension of the decision of the drivers. And I asked him, what is this for? Like, we're beating Michael Schumacher, Nico Rosberg with a much less budget than them. We're doing a great job with tires, with management of the strategies. What's going on here? Like, why? And he told me, he was very straight to me, like he always was. And he said, you have to win a race. You really have to win a race.
In a Toro Rosso?
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, you know what I'm going to do? And I told him that straight away on a Friday evening in Suzuka. And I said, I'm going to win on Sunday, but I don't care what's going to happen and what the stewards will say, because I'm not going to do the last chicane. I'm going to go straight. I'm going to cut the last chicane. because it's 1.5 seconds missing. So Hamilton is on pole, or whoever was, I think Vettel was on pole. I'm missing 1.5 seconds. I know your car has 180 points of downforce more than my car. There's no chance I can go 1.5 seconds, even 0.2. You know, I'm like giving my very best on every corner. So let's do a deal. I sign this paper. I win on Sunday, but I'm not doing the last chicane. I'm cutting every single lap. He started laughing, and then I left the meeting room.
it was your last year.
And it was my last year.
I'm just joining the dots here.
It was crazy. It was crazy.
Let's talk a little bit about 2010, because there's a couple of moments I wanted to ask you about. One was right at the start in Australia. You had a cracking battle with Michael Schumacher, kept him at bay for 20 odd laps. And then the very next race, you score your first points in Formula One at Sepang. Are those two events linked? Did you learn something from racing Schumacher that helped you 2 weeks later?
Yeah, absolutely. Michael, for me, is my reference also in life, because I think I didn't have much relationship with him, but we were in Formula One at the same time. And for me, it was great to compete against him. He gave me a few tips, lifestyle tips in Jerez, which were great. And I still think about what he said, you know. And also in Australia, for me, that race, it was charismatic, because we were both struggling with tire degradation. The race was, in Australia, you always try to finish the race because there's so many retirements and so many issues with the cars and safety cars and so on. And I remember he beat me at the end, but I didn't make it easy for him. And then in the next race, I scored some points. I finished ninth. And of course, there's always something to take when you raced against Michael, because he always put you into a limit, whether you crash or you hold back, or yeah, he just puts you into that position where, you know, you have to put yourself into the back, because he's not gonna hold it off, you know, he's gonna go for it. So absolutely, he's a fighter, and he's always been a fighter. So a huge admiration for him. But also I have to say that 2009, my previous half season, helped me to build that extra confidence and extra knowledge of how to drive these kind of cars to this level. But it was a difficult year, even though, I mean, 2010 was the very first year that Toro Rosso built a car in Italy. Before that, the car was built in Milton Keynes. It was a Red Bull racing car. It's very important that we understand that, because Toro Rosso in 2008 was not Toro Rosso. 2009 was not Toro Rosso. It was really in 2010, where Toro Rosso starts to build and design a proper car in Faenza. Since then.
Yep.
And year one.
And so that race that Vettel won at Monza in 2008 and Helmut wanted you to replicate.
Yeah, that car was always in Q3. I mean, I don't want to take any merit out of Sebastian. He's a great, great racing driver. And you know, he's a great person as well. And I admire all he deserves every single championship he won. But we have to say, when he was in Toro Rosso, that car, you look at the average of qualifying, he's almost every single time in Q3. Both cars, not just
And it was very often faster than the Red Bull racing cars, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Of David Coulthard and Mark Webber. And how did Vettel winning the championship in 2010 affect the whole Red Bull F1 program? I remember talking to a Red Bull employee at the end of 2010, after Vettel had won the title in Abu Dhabi. And he was actually concerned that Red Bull might pull out of Formula One because Vettel winning the championship meant that they had achieved what they'd set out to do in Formula One. Luckily, obviously, that didn't happen. But was there a marked shift in the mentality of the bosses, if you like, of Helmut and Christian, even Franz Tost?
I don't think so. No. I think at some point they were thinking who would be replacing Sebastian Vettel when he left. Of course, that was maybe a concern. But then they found Max, of course. But they always found a way to be competitive. And that was thanks to Adrian Newey. Since Red Bull had Adrian Newey, they were secure that they were going to be competitive in Formula One. And at the end of the day, and I'm sorry to say this, in Formula One, it's not sure now, because I think now, for this year, actually, I think it's going to be the year where we're going to see the most closest racing in history of Formula One, honestly. And that's great. This year, how many different race winners? Seven? This year, I think. And maybe this year it's possible to have even more. So I think that's great because it makes racing even better. But back then, back in the day, there was big difference of performance between the cars. So I don't really think that Helmut Mark or Christian or the board of Red Bull had in mind to pull off the game. Yeah.
That was never mentioned.
I don't think so, no.
No. Well, clearly, that, you know, they got a huge amount out of winning in Formula One, didn't they? Let's now go on to 2011. Far and away, your best season in Formula One. 7 points finishes. You finish ahead of your teammate Sebastian Buemi in the championship. Why do you think that season in particular went so well?
Because it started really bad. Honestly, it started so bad. There was these Pirelli tires coming in. We thought we understood them, but we had so many issues in the first races, in testing, so much degradation. The rears went off massively, more than the rest. Everyone had issues, but we were struggling more than the rest. Then I understood a couple of things of the car. I lived in Faenza for a couple of weeks, worked hard with my engineer, see some differences on driving styles and also how to set up my car, made the car a little bit more understeery. I suffered more in qualifying. You know, in qualifying, you couldn't change the car from qualifying to the race. So we were struggling qualifying with understeering. But then in the race, when the race was coming, wow, we were flying. We were really, when we got there in half season, there were starting some rumors that maybe I was being replaced because I was underperforming. It was really, really bad. And I was like, oh my God, I don't know how we're going to solve this because I'm not understanding this car. We're consuming so much the rear tires. I'm doing one more stop than my teammate. This is not working at all. And then all of a sudden, one race to the other, it was Valencia 2011. I remember with 20 race finishes, like everyone in the grid finished the race, and from P17, I finished P8. Then in Canada, from the pit lane, I finished again in 8th. So this kind of racing was all due to setup change and me, myself, understanding well
how to drive the car.
Yeah, how to drive the car in order to save the rear tires. And it was massively different. And then nobody understood. And then I remember Eddie Jordan, he was telling me, but what did you do? And I said, listen, man, I'm the same. I'm just the same. It's just that I understood how to drive this car. The setup, I changed a little bit. The setup of the car would change in the suspensions. The car is more on the steering. I'm saving more the rear tires. And this allows me from lap 15 onwards to do lap times because I have more grip than the rest. And that's why we were beating Mercedes at some point. That's why, you know, you saw that overtaking to Nico Rosberg in Korea in the last lap.
Best race of the year for you, I think. Yeah. Korea had to be.
And Monza, P7. So all these, it was actually a fake results because in one lap time, like pure lap time speed on qualifying, our car was not able to replicate their lap times. But if you were doing a good strategy and if you were really taking care of the rear tires, we could beat these guys. And this was human work, only human work.
And always drive just under the limit?
Was
always that was the secret?
Yeah, 80%, 85%. Never pushing to start with, especially when with a lot of fuel in the car. just trying to save the rear tires, always trying to be in a good position in the race. And that was making a huge difference at the end of the race, yeah.
And how different was that approach to what you'd had to do with the Bridgestones the previous year?
With the Bridgestones was completely different. With the Bridgestones was qualifying every lap. You could push every single moment. I mean, you do feel the old tires as well, but they were not, the drop-off was not as huge as with Pirellis. The track evolution with Pirellis was high, but was not as high as with Bridgestones. Now, Pirelli have changed massively since the first year they've entered Formula One. But honestly, I think we should go back to these days where drivers were complaining and were struggling with tire degradation. It was great. I mean, like really, really struggling, not just a bit.
I think, though, driving under the limit isn't Formula One.
No, at all. Not at all.
But are you saying that actually for the drivers that could work it out were invariably the better drivers, so therefore actually the cream was still rising to the top, even with that high degradation?
Absolutely. I just feel now, Formula One, honestly, with how the rules are at this point, the tire is too big to start with, and there's too much downforce. The cars have too much grip. They're too quick in the corners. There's no need to make a good show and a good racing, even though it's great. But I don't know, I feel like, let's put an example. You put the onboard of Michael Schumacher in 1998 in Barcelona, and you look at the onboard of Michael, and you then put in the other screen, you put Max on his pole position lap last year in Barcelona. And Max looks like he's on Excalextric. He's not moving the wheel. He's so smooth. The car is so predictable, even though he's going so fast, so quick. It's so predictable that you just don't expect anything, you know? And when you see back in the day, the car was moving, the car was just unpredictable. It was wild. We want to see that, right?
We do. Although, can I pick holes in your example?
Yeah.
In that I think 1998 was the first year of the groove tyres. And I think the cars were moving around a lot more. Let's back to back Villeneuve in 1997, the last year of the slicks with Max today. I think that would be an interesting comparison.
It would be because I think it wouldn't change much. I think back in the day, and we don't have to go that so much back. Like also if you go 2006 or 2005 from Fernando driving the Renault or even Michael driving the Ferrari. Wow, for me, that was more spectacular driving. Now I see there's too much grip. These cars have too much grip. They need to move more. The drivers have to fast. They have to fight. And I would think they have to fight more with the car. And I think they would have to struggle to find the grip. I think Pirelli tires are too big. This rear tire is insane. And the cars generate too much downforce. Wow.
Well, look, you're not the only person thinking this. We've got a massive regulation change coming
indeed.
Next year.
And I hope it works because I think we're going to see even more amazing racing, much more fun, especially for the drivers, honestly.
Watch that space in 2026. But Jaime, you talk about how you were able to work out how to get the best from the Pirelli tyres. What do you think was your greatest strength as a racing driver?
To work outside, understand the car, to work in the simulator, to work with the engineers, understand the weight distributions, understand the aero updates, if we had any, every single change we had in the car, then I could extract 120% out of it, or I could extract my very, very best, even though I think we've never seen my very, very best. It was yet to be seen. And that was that. That's my, I would say, that was a bit sad in a way, and my frustration in Formula One, because I was expecting to see more with a different team. Of course, with Red Bull, that's what I was expecting. But I think my strength was, to work hard outside of the car.
Do you think you would have developed even faster had you had different teammates? You had Buemi alongside you all the way through. Do you think if you just had two or three different teammates, you would have learned more develop faster?
The only thing I can say is that a driver who's only increasing his performance and beating his teammate, just delivering points, results versus money, because at the end of the day, it's just putting the car in the points means that you're bringing money to the team somehow, because results means money. You can't stop a 21-year-old kid. You just give him, just keep going. You know, there's more to be seen from this guy. He's coming in a good path. You know, he got something. He got something mid-season that is not expected and is working out. Don't stop him now. Like, it shouldn't be done this way.
I remember thinking that at the time. So how much, I mean, how much of a shock was it when you got the bad news just before Christmas at the end of 2011?
Well, it changed my life completely. Like, mentally destroyed me massively.
If it's not too painful to share.
No, absolutely.
How were you told?
I'm fine now because many years happened, of course, many, many years. But it destroyed my life. It destroyed my life because the way it happened, you know, 18th of December of 2011, I was in Madrid launching the car for the following year. I remember we had James Key coming in as a technical director in Toro Rosso. We had good expectations for the next year, even though it was going to be the third year of the car being designed and developed in Faenza. But we were with high hopes. And then all of a sudden, the following day, I refused an offer from Lotus. Eric Boullier called me.
That offer came in Abu Dhabi.
In Abu Dhabi, obviously, they asked me to sign in the racetrack because Kimi was coming back from rallying. They wanted a second driver, they call it, with experience, knowing, understanding well the tires. Indeed, my profile was fitting well because I was then delivering good results and they were like, okay, we want you in, but it has to be now. Because obviously the other option was Roman Grosjean, but it wasn't sure. So they asked me to do it. I said, listen, I've been with these guys all my career. It's going really well. With Red Bull, I mean, I don't believe nothing bad could happen.
Did you have a contract for 2012?
No, I didn't. But I didn't feel like leaving. Probably, well, it was definitely the wrong move on my side. And obviously that car was amazing. Imagine, you know.
Well, Kimi Raikkonen went on to win a race in it the following year.
Imagine.
Was it 8 podiums?
So I after 2 months, I found myself out and with no expectations to go in. Helmut Marko told me, on his way of talking, to call HRT. They might have a seat. I didn't even want to call HRT to be P20. So I stayed home and then I did Pirelli testing, which kept me somehow active in Formula One. But then a few teams called. They asked me for sponsorship, which I didn't have. But it's all good. The only thing that bothered me was how they did it. You know, they waited till the very, very last second in order that we didn't have a chance to sign with any other team, and that hurt a lot.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18-plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpoints.tc.
Can I take you back to Abu Dhabi and Lotus? So Eric Boullier, the team principal, has said to you, Jaime, we want you for next year. Sign here.
Yeah.
You're 21 years old. Did you have a manager?
No.
So
I had a friend. I had a friend.
You seem very ill-equipped to deal. I mean, did you then, or your friend, go back to Red Bull and say, I need to know about next year now?
No, we didn't do it. We didn't do it. We probably, my mistake was, not just in Formula One, also after that I was not in an environment. It was in a good enough environment to be taught and to take the right decisions at the right time. probably because I didn't have the visuals or I didn't have the experience to understand what we should do. But that's why a manager is needed. And I never got one. I always was with my friend, with my dad. And
if you're on the Red Bull Young Driver program, is there the feeling that you don't need a manager because Red Bull will look after you?
No, I think you need a manager. A manager that precisely works for your future. And when I say future, it doesn't have to be only Formula One. It needs to be your future as a job. Or maybe, obviously, I didn't want this for my life because thankfully I had something else to do, which I really love, which is music. But many people don't have the chance to be in Formula One, even though if they are talented and if they are super skilled to be in Formula One. But they might have other chances to go somewhere else and be paid well and do a great living out of racing, which is also great. It's not my type of life because I didn't want to do it, but many other people decided to do it like this and it works. So I do think it's very necessary to have the right environment to help you out to take the right decision, especially if you're 20 years old. Come on, you don't know anything about life when you're 20. Yeah.
And so when you look at a Grand Prix today, I think you do a little bit of work for Spanish TV still, don't you?
Yeah.
Do you look at a race from a driver's perspective or are you looking at it from a fan's perspective?
I always look it from a driver's perspective. Indeed, I still look it as a driver's perspective and I will always look it as a driver's perspective. Now, it still hurts a little bit. Back in the day, I couldn't watch a Formula One race.
How long did it take you to get over it?
3-4 years. I mean, I got a trauma out of it. I wanted to, I felt so much hate for the persons and for the people who actually helped me to reach Formula One. So at the same time, I have to thank Red Bull because without them, I would have never, ever made it anywhere. So they were the ones to help me out to race. They were the ones to pay for my career. Every single junior driver knows that. So we have to be very, very thankful, even Max, everyone, to Red Bull.
How about you and Helmut Marko? Have you been able to...
Yeah, I saw him at Silverstone. I went to Silverstone last year.
In 2024?
Yeah, and I have no concerns, even though he could be the one or, I don't know, whoever took the decision of drop us out at the end in that day, all of a sudden. But I don't care anymore, you know, I have a good memory of Formula One, even though of the guys who decided not to continue for myself, but I don't care. So I was there in a good mood because Carlos invited me. We were in the Ferrari garage. I was with my partner, with Loic. And then we went to have, you know, coffee. And I saw Helmut Marko going there and going around. And I just went to say hi. And he didn't care much about me, honestly. He recognized me, but he didn't spend time with me, which honestly, I don't even expect him to do so. Because I don't remember, I don't have a memory of him being friendly, you know. But it's fine, it's all good.
It's kind of like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a comparison. Is it like a headmaster at school? They're not friends, are they? And if you saw them in later life, would you expect to have a long conversation with them? Probably not.
I think he has a character inside him. He's a policeman, like the policeman that wants to act as a policeman, like the serious policeman who's always like being, you know, like very strict and like all this behavior. But I don't think he's really like, maybe he's not like that. I don't know. I don't know.
I think a lot of people asking this question, yeah, about Helmut probably. You mentioned that you went to Silverstone with Carlos Sainz. So it suggests you and him are quite matey.
Yeah, yeah. I'm very close to Carlos since his very early days in go-karts. Indeed, my family gave him probably one of his first, very first go-karts. And my dad is very close to Carlos Sr. as well. And me and Carlos Jr. talk very often about his life, especially now about his present and his thoughts. He's an excellent human being. He's an excellent sportsman. I envy many aspects of his behavior, of his knowledge, of his attitude, his how he addresses to the press, his elegance, his class. He's so smart. You know, he's out there and he's never losing his mind. He's always, when he's under pressure or he's slower than Charles or he's, let's say, made a mistake, you see him chilled. You know, he's always looks like he's under control. This gives you that feeling of security, which is insane. And I really, really admire him for that. It's really, really great how he has developed his skill. And look, if you analyze Carlos' career, he's always been increasing his performance. And there's always something coming up from him. Always something coming up that you don't expect. And it's always a surprise. And I think this year with Williams, we're going to see amazing things from him.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, in that him being squeezed out of Ferrari, there are parallels with what happened in your career as well. I think he thought he was going to be retained by Ferrari for 2025. And I think Hamilton signing was caught him by surprise. And he's told us on this podcast that he found it very, very difficult to deal with. Okay, you were being squeezed out of Toro Rosso and out of Formula One, but have you and him ever discussed your two experiences?
Yeah, we have. In a way, it's different, of course. Carlos has won four races last year and he has done an amazing season with an amazing car. Honestly, I think there was nothing to do to avoid that situation for Carlos. Maybe there was something to do with me to avoid that situation I had. But it's not the end of Carlos' career, you know, and there's so much hope. There's a change of regulation in 2026, and come on now, Formula One, everything is open, everything can happen. I would wish I could be in Formula One now just by the fact that it's the closest ever Formula One racing in history. That's insane. For every single fan who follows Formula One, they should know that. It was never like this. It's never back in the Ferrari days, never was like that. And that's great to see.
And when the cars are so close together, that puts even more emphasis on the drivers.
Absolutely. Drivers, strategies, there's going to be much more incidents because, of course, everything is super close. So you're really fighting for a million of a second, you know, a tenth of a second. Everything is going to be just single, very precise details.
Jaime, I think a tenth of a second might be three rows on the grid.
Yeah, indeed. So 1,000 of a second.
Do you get to many races these days, or are you too busy with the music? Because a bit like your time in Formula One, I'm guessing a lot of the gigs you're doing are at weekends.
Yeah. Almost all the shows that we have are at weekends. So
tell us a bit about Jaime Alguersuari, the DJ now.
Yeah. So I run a project with my partner Loic in music. It's called Pole Position.
You came up with that name.
Yeah, as the word. Well, actually, he came up with that name, and as the word says, Pole Position. It refers to me. Funnily enough, I met Loic. Without knowing, we met each other because he was a fan of Formula One since many, many years ago with his dad. And he was at the Montreal Grand Prix, which was the longest ever Formula One race ever. And I finished P8 starting from the pit lane, the one that
2011.
It rained. Yeah, 2011.
Jensen wins. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It was an epic race. And we decided to give this name and everything, you know, like all the marketing and image is all around, let's say, racing, but it's not super clear. Our music is also not very predictable music in a way. Like, it's electronic music, but it infuses many things, you know. Like, it's very innovative. It's housey. It has melodies. It has vocals. But it's not, let's say, very, 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 very super commercial, if we should call it. It's very difficult to tag music nowadays, whether it's more like a feeling if you like it or not.
Who are your biggest influences?
In electronic music, probably you would not know most of them, but Moby. I really, really love Moby. Everything he does, obviously the albums from 1998, 1999, it's more, it's really electronic, but I'm sure you know some of his music, just you don't know the name. And more like in the clubbing scene, I like Am, German DJ. I really like them as producers and also as DJs.
What do you think of the music that Charles Leclerc does? Have you listened to any of the music that Charles done?
No, I haven't. No. It's classical music?
He's a pianist. And I think his biggest song, I think it was I think it's had like 15 million downloads.
I heard about it. Wow, that's great. I wish I could play the piano. Unfortunately, I didn't have a career when I was younger, when I didn't take lessons. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, to make electronic music, it's important to have ideas, a little bit of musical knowledge. It's not crucial to know, you know, all the huge combinations of chords and so on. With very little, you can make so much. And especially now that technology is so developed that everyone can make hits, honestly. It's a bit sad, but it's as it is.
I remember Charles telling me that he has a creative mind.
Hmm.
And it did spark the thought, do you see driving racing cars as a form of artistry?
You know, I think this is probably the most amazing question I've ever been asked.
Come on, homie. It's not like...
No, I love it. I love it because I've always thought about it. What is it driving a race car to the limit? Is it art? I would say it is. I think it is. It is an art because I think an art is a form of expression by whomever expresses it. But it can be interpreted by whomever is interfered the message in a very subjective way. Did I make myself clear?
Yes. Yeah.
It's very difficult because art is subjective. You can understand if this is green or blue, but maybe for me this is good or bad. I cannot tell you this is good or bad because maybe I like it or you don't like it. So art is subjective. It's not a competition. And racing is a competition, but driving a car to the limit on the wet in difficult circumstance is an art. It's definitely, it has to be an art, I would say.
And do you think the fastest laps are the ones that look slowest from the outside?
Yeah.
Smoothness.
This is what we said, that onboard lap time from Lando Norris or Max in Silverstone or in Barcelona, smoothest high-speed racetracks where you just want to put so much minimum speed in the car and you don't want to have any correction is what's going to make you faster.
And then with your music, what ambitions do you have for it?
My ambition, firstly, is to enjoy the whole process. I think this is something I miss in Formula One. If you ask me, did you enjoy while you were in Formula One? Well, while I was there in that time, I'm not sure if I did. Now, in perspective, I think I did enjoy it. I think the whole picture was good, but I just want to extract much more from the momentum, from the now, from the present. We are all putting so much expectations. You know, we want to be there, we want to do that, we want to have that. But the world and life is going and happening so fast and so quick that we should care more about the now, about this interview, about this conversation, about what we're doing now. We're healthy, we're alive, we are, you know, enjoying the present. And I think this is something I miss and I lack in my adolescence, back when I was a racing driver. And this is my ambition at the moment. This is what I want to do. I'm doing it now. I'm having so much fun. I just end up my tour in South America. We played in Punta del Este, in Argentina, in Tulum.
In front of how many people?
We did this amazing concert in Buenos Aires in front of 12,000 people, which was
amazing.
Big. And then, for here in Barcelona for Sonar, as well, and so many other places. You know, we play.
You're all over the place, aren't you?
Yes, we're starting to play in some festivals, which is great, and we're enjoying. But again, honestly, it's not really about the population or about the popularity for me. Club music and electronic music is about sharing the love and the message and the storytelling of the song with the people that really feel the same. When you're in a festival with so much people, yeah, you see all these hands and so on, but they're so far away. You know, maybe sometimes a little club with, I don't know, with 500 people, it's enough to have this feeling of family, you know?
And when you're playing in a club, is that experience as immersive as when you're driving a racing car?
It's very different. It's very different because for me, music is all about, as I said, sharing. You are not the main character. Even though if it looks like, it's not about you. It's about them. You go to play for the people. You go to give love and to give pleasure to people to have fun. Then it's yourself after them. But people obviously expect you for a sound to play that song. But it's really, for me, it's really about them. It's really about people having fun. In racing, when you are in the race car and you put your helmet on, it's not about them. It's really, really about you. You never, never think about them. The last thing you think is about them. So there are very, very different thoughts that requires different attention for both activities.
Jaime, I cannot tell you how much I've enjoyed this chat.
Me too.
It's been really fun. I've got one more Formula One question to ask you. And then can you just have a think about a song that maybe we could play to see out the rest of the show? But have a think about that while you're answering this question. Mm-hmm. 2025 is the 75th anniversary of Formula One. We had the great launch at the O2 at the start of the season. I'm asking all of my guests this year this question, which is, do you have a favourite moment or a favourite race in history?
I don't want to sound selfish. It has
Korea 2011.
Yes. It has to be mine because, of course, yeah, I've lived a very little part of the history of Formula One. But for me, being in the point, it was like a race win. And I remember that race with, you know, having Nico in the front for like 30 laps, being P7, and there was no chance I could overtake him. And I did something that I didn't even thought it was possible. The overtake itself was not spectacular, but the way we did it, the way I thought about it, was quite a Carlos Sainz kind of thing, which was saving all the curse system back then after turn one, because after turn one, there was a huge straight. And then adding to the curse, then the DRS zone. So I gained so much speed and I couldn't do it. I could only do that on the last lap because I knew he had more pace than I. So if there were more laps remaining, he would have overtook me by after that. So I would have to say that was my best race.
It really was a great race.
Yeah, it was. It was really nice.
All right. And, look, and what are we going to listen to see out the show?
So we are going to listen a track we made and we are very excited. It's called Taking It Back. And we're going to listen to that song because the sample of the song says the vocals, Taking It Back, because it was an interview where we took it back. We took it back 13 years ago.
We have done that.
Exactly. So we want to take those memories back to our feelings. Plus, I love this song because it takes you in a journey of a really beautiful breakbeat and a melody that is like a progressive sound that keeps you going and going. And yeah, it's really nice.
Jaime, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Great tune, Jaime. We have indeed taken it back 13 years over the last hour or so. What a fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Jaime is such an intelligent and thoughtful man, and his perspective on his Formula One career 15 years on is so enlightening.
what he learned from racing Michael Schumacher in 2010, the conversations he had with Helmut Marko, how music saved his life after his Formula One career. It's an incredible story, made all the more relevant by what's happened recently with Liam Lawson being demoted from Red Bull Racing. Jaime, thanks for your time. It was great to spend the day with you in Barcelona. Well, that's almost it from me this week. If you haven't already got the F1 app on your phone, it's well worth downloading for all the latest F1 news and video, and you can even listen to our podcasts on it as well. Thanks for listening. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. But for now, F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by F1 and Audio Boom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
Okay, only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first, there, the last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.